Let me be clear. The United States government has no interest in running GM. We have no intention of running GM. What we are interested in is giving GM an opportunity to finally make those much-needed changes that will let them emerge from this crisis a stronger and more competitive company.
Hello and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm David Kestenbaum in Washington, D.C., and guess who's back?
It's me. I'm Laura Conaway, and I'm so back, David.
How's your trip to Mississippi?
You know, it was great, and I saw almost my whole family, and pretty much everybody was well-behaved, which is all you can ask, I think, from a visit home. Today is Monday, March 30th, 2009. On today's show, we're going to talk about President Obama's new plan for the American automobile industry.
We're also going to look at how much Americans are saving compared to the rest of the world and talk to a guy who thinks this whole financial crisis is actually a bit of a distraction from a much larger problem on the horizon. I'm not kidding you. And he actually makes a pretty convincing case.
Okay. First, before we go over that cliff, our Planet Money indicator, it's 2. That's the percentage drop in margin debt at the New York Stock Exchange.
So margin debt is when you borrow money to buy stock. Like, that stock's worth $3. I only got $1. That's okay. I borrowed the other 2 to buy it. And then if it drops in value, I have to sell it to make sure I can pay those people back. But that's what margin debt is. And it's been falling very fast from September to October. Margin debt at the stock exchange fell by 22%. And we're kind of looking for it to bottom out.
And from January to February, here's the new news. Margin debt seems to have stabilized almost. It dropped only 2%.
So we got interested in this alternate indicator because of a note from a currency strategist, this guy Mark Chandler.
Yeah, Chandler works here in New York City with Brown Brothers Harriman. He wrote a note saying basically that the economic crisis is more or less a problem of deleveraging, that people and businesses and banks took on too much debt, too much leverage, and they've been trying to get rid of it as fast as they can.
So he's been watching for that deleveraging process to stop, which is why he's watching the margin, the total amount of margin debt. And he's waiting and watching for people to start being willing to take on some risk, start willing to buy things on margin again.
Right, to say, well, I don't have enough money to buy the stock. I have some. Maybe I can borrow a little bit. Chandler says we just flat are not there yet. We're just flat not done deleveraging, even with the pace of deleveraging in this one small category seeming to slow down. Chandler says, yes, for margin debt to fall just 2%, that's a hopeful sign. But he cautions that one swallow doesn't make a spring.
And, hey, Laura, today the United States government did something that we have just about never seen it do before.
That's right. It stepped in and it gave these very specific instructions to a couple of major private corporations, namely Chrysler and GM.
They've been asking the federal government for loans, as we all know, trying to stay out of bankruptcy. They have already gotten about $17 billion.
And now the Obama administration is telling Chrysler that it can't make it on its own and it has to hook up with Fiat. And that's if it wants another $6 billion loan from the U.S. So I talked to a guy who has a very, very vested interest in this outcome. His name is Joe Grossi. He works in a Chrysler plant outside Detroit. He stamps the doors on the Jeep Cherokee. He got the news in the factory cafeteria.
Well, everybody was pretty quiet, which doesn't happen very often, but we're all paying attention and watching. And I would say the move was kind of frustrating.
Kind of frustrated?
With things kind of being out of our control. As the workers go, I mean, there's a lot of things that have been happening with the company that we wish they would have been more on top of. Got a jump start on as far as, cafe standards and stuff like that.
Moving into greener cars and that kind of thing faster?
Right.
How do you feel about making Fiats?
I got a family to feed, so at this point, anything that would make me feel secure, I'd be all right doing.
Has anyone in management said to you what that might mean for you, Joe Grossi? I mean, would you be making Fiats?
No. There's barely any contact with management anymore, and there's nothing really said. Every few months, we'll have a town hall meeting with the plant manager, and they'll tell us some things that we need to hear or they want us to hear. But other than that, there's, you know, they know just about as much as we do, or at least that's what they claim.
Have you yourself started thinking about what you might do if there is no auto industry in Detroit?
Yeah, think about it all the time. Haven't come up with anything great. We don't plan on leaving the area, so really have limited options. I mean, automotive is you can't say how much automotive means to this area. And, I mean, I've got friends that have been out of work for, you know, months up to years, and looking around, sending out hundreds of resumes, and it's a huge deal when they get called for one interview out of 100 resumes. And so you think about what you want to do, you know, if they were to close up tomorrow, but, you know, realistically, there's not a whole lot of options.
So, folks, the last time we talked to Joe Grassi for the podcast was in December. He had just been laid off for something like the dozenth time, even more. He says he loses track. Since December, he's been sent home with most of his wages, thanks to the union, but sent home two or three more times.
Wow. You know, the other big part of President Obama's plan is new leadership at GM. I mean, this is amazing. We had the federal government coming in basically deciding who runs these companies. In this case, they asked CEO Rick Wagoner to leave, and he's leaving.
Yeah, that's it for him. This is the kind of move that we've been wondering whether the government might make in the case of all the big banks it's been bailing out.
Right. I mean, I think that's a really interesting question, right? People have been wanting the government to take more of a role at the banks, and they haven't really done it. But with the auto companies, they seem willing to do it, even though the auto companies seem to be a smaller part of the problem.
I wanted to figure out more about why the banks in Detroit are getting such completely different treatment here. So I went to a professor named John Macy. He's a deputy dean at Yale Law School. He's a historian who's helped us understand business and the economy and sort of the historical scale for this podcast before. John Macy says he has never seen the government step in quite this way before, ever.
The Obama administration, you know, via, you know, Tim Geithner, takes the view that the management of the banks is part of the solution and the management of the auto companies is part of the problem. Now, they had, you know, Tim Geithner really is strongly of the mindset that you know, that these companies are well managed and that we ought to, you know, we need to keep them alive. Or, you know, and also it's very important to think about the fundamental difference between an automotive company and an investment bank, right? An automotive company is a manufacturing plant with billions and billions of dollars in actual hard assets, right? Whereas an investment bank is just a bunch of people, you know, who are kind of going out and making deals and adding value through essentially human capital.
The business assets are basically in their heads.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you don't believe in management, you know, if you don't believe, you know, the idea of putting zillions of dollars, as we've done, into these guarantees for these investment banks is we've already shown we obviously think these people are great because we want to keep these firms together with the exception of Lehman Brothers. We want to keep them all together as going concerns.
You study this stuff a lot. I know you know a lot about the history of business and economics in the United States and also
right.
The world, but you've never seen this kind of direct, you will do this in exchange for aid move from the U.S. government to a company.
Right. No, never. And, you know, I've never seen a situation in which the public is this frustrated, exasperated, and just downright depressed over, you know, what it's costing to kind of bail out these failed management teams.
Do you think President Obama just has to change sort of the temperature a little bit? He can't do the same thing they've done with the banks, where they put money into them and let them just kind of keep going. They have to do something different with Detroit.
Well, I think that that they have to do something different in general. That is to say, I don't think people see a bailout as a bailout, and if you're bailing out, you know, General Motors, or you're bailing out Wells Fargo or, Bank of America is a better example. You know, what's the difference? One difference is that these auto firms have been failing for a lot longer. You know, the investment banks had a few good years. They keep all the billions from that in the form of bonuses, and they have a bad year, and we're bailing them out. But the automotive companies, you know, this has been a very slow pitch over the plate to the government, and everybody, you know, who's come within, you know, 50 miles of Detroit realizes that, you know, the American automotive industry has not been viable for a very long time. And if it wasn't going to be the downturn of 2007 that got them, it would have been the downturn of, you know, 2009 or 2011. That, you know, these firms were just zombies waiting to collapse.
There's that word, zombie banks, zombie firms.
Yep. Well, you need the government to have zombie. If it weren't for the government, these things would die. It's the zombies that keeps the dead walking.
It's interesting to see that in this case, the automakers are asking Washington for a loan, and the government seems to be saying, well, we might lend you some money, but only on these terms. They're being a much more careful creditor, I think.
Right. Well, you know, the fact that nobody believes that there would be, you know, any harm, systemic harm from letting these automobile companies fail. No one who wants an automobile is going to, you know, General Motors could fail, Chrysler could fail, you know, and anybody in the United States who wants to go out and buy a car will be able to go out and buy a car the next day.
Our listeners, I have to tell you, our listeners in Michigan and Ohio,
right,
and those places where they have jobs that are either directly, you know, putting the doors on cars or building the handles that go into the doors that go on the cars, for them, the collapse of the auto industry would very much represent a systemic catastrophe.
Oh, yeah. Well, it would definitely be a regional catastrophe for the, you know, Detroits and the Akrons. There's no question about that. The people who are building, who are working for these automobile companies. I do not believe it would be a catastrophe for the suppliers, as many people do, because the suppliers, you know, are going to be just, you know, they're going to reconfigure and supply elsewhere.
Supply something else to someone else?
Well, yeah. I mean, in other words, there's no... You know, this doesn't represent any change in the demand for cars. It just represents a reconfiguration of the supply of cars. So, you know, this is going to be good news for Ford. It's going to be good news for Subaru. It's going to be good news for Toyota and Honda, despite their protestations to the contrary.
I'm still a little bit surprised that you seem so comfortable with the U.S. government saying a CEO of a private company has to step down.
Well, you know, here's a couple things. Number one, let's just think about banking, okay? For decades, since 1933, when we had deposit insurance implemented, we've had the government of the United States in the form of banking regulators theoretically making assessments about management quality. Number two, once the government is in the role, as it is with, you know, commercial banks, FDIC-insured banks, as an insurer, or as it is with the auto companies as a lender, or as it is with AIG as a you know, equity investor, you know, they have the same rights as you or I have when we play those roles. And, you know, people have long gone to banks for loans, and if they think it's a good business model, but they think the management is, you know, running the firm in the ground, they say, well, you're going to change management, we're not going to give you a loan. You know, so once these guys come begging to the government for financing, you know, all bets are off. It completely changes the relationship between, you know, the government is acting in these capacities, in my view, as a private sector actor, and they have the same rights to bargain for in order to protect their investments as any private sector actor, and they ought to avail themselves of the rights so they're not doing their job in protecting our money.
Now, David, one of the reasons I was so surprised about John Macy being cool with the Wagner change is that he is really a free market leaning kind of person who believes very strongly that some of these banks should be allowed to fail, and he says he wouldn't loan Detroit a plug nickel.
All right. Thanks, Laura. We will link to an op-ed from John Macy on our blog, npr.org/money. On Friday, a new set of numbers came out from the Commerce Department, and we're going to dig a bit into one really interesting number, which is the savings rate. The savings rate now sits at 4.4%, and the savings rate is the fraction of our paychecks that we save. So it's at 4.4% now.
Yeah, and you always hear people saying, oh, you know, we don't save enough. I wish I could, but I know I don't. Americans don't save enough, or that people in Japan or China save way too much. We wanted to try to understand what the right level of savings would be.
Right. So I actually have a chart here. And for years in the 60s and 70s, we were saving around 8%. And then beginning around in the 80s until just before the crisis, it steadily just sort of went down. It actually went negative recently. So now it is heading steeply up. We are saving more. As we said, it's 4.4%. I talked to Kent Smetters at Wharton, the University of Pennsylvania's business school, about it.
So historically, this is actually a high number, but it's still low in comparison to other countries.
So why are people doing this? If people are losing their jobs and they're strapped, you would think they would not have any extra money to save. Is it because people who do have jobs are saying, you know, I'm worried and they're in so far I'm going to try to put more away right now?
This is this what we call precautionary saving or rainy day type saving. People are a little worried and they want to save more in case they lose their job.
And the flip side of this is that they spend less, which is what everyone's so worried about because a large part of GDP, 70%, is that right, is consumer spending.
Right.
And when you say that savings rate is not as high as it should be, and I'm sure there are people who disagree with you, you know, right, on one side and the other, why do you say that? Because people just need to be saving for retirement and they run into trouble if they don't do that? Or do you mean that in a bigger macro sense?
In both. People need to put away more money for retirement than they currently are, even assuming that Social Security and Medicare is going to be around for them, which those programs are in serious deficit. They still don't have enough money to finance the type of standard of living that they enjoy pre-retirement.
Mm-hmm. You said you also mean it in a larger kind of good for the economy sense, it's better if people save more?
Yeah, it's better if people have more saving. It's going to lend itself to more capital, and that's going to produce higher wages. For example, if you never saved, if no one ever saved money, then literally the only type of goods that we would be consuming are just someone cutting down some random corn or something, selling that to you.
Yeah, I was going to say fruit, right? You got to be able to like pull fruit. It off the trees with no investment and sell it. Yeah,
exactly.
Hey, Laura, so let's explain that last part a little bit.
Okay.
Savings is good, he says, because imagine if nobody saved, like zero savings. People just spent all their income. The banks then would have no depositors.
Yeah, it's like if you went to the bank and all the tellers were just kind of sitting there totally bored, reading the newspaper and texting. And it's just no one comes in to open an account or put anything in an account.
Right. So the problem with this, then, is that if you, Laura, wanted to start some new business, I mean, maybe you wanted to go drill for oil or build a hotel.
I'm thinking of it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, too bad, because you can't get the money to get started because the banks don't have any to lend out. And it's actually worse than that, because the savings and savings rate, it's not just money we put into our savings account. It actually includes all other investments you might make, buying stock, buying bonds. So if you don't save, it means you're also not buying stock, which means there are no investors to provide money for new companies. I mean, it's just like nothing happens.
So no savings, that's obviously bad.
Right. Also, though, too much savings is bad. Because if everyone somehow is able to put their entire check into their savings account, like, you know, I went home at the end of the day and I just did nothing somehow.
that I've ever tried that.
Yeah, and I didn't have rent to pay somehow. You know, they would have nothing left over to spend, right? No one would be buying anything. So now, like, imagine a restaurant and it's just quiet. Like, you can hear the music perfectly. Nobody comes in, empty tables, waiters standing around. Well, you know, they got to fire everybody. So no spending, you have no commerce.
Also bad.
So we want a savings rate somewhere between 0% and 100% savings.
Okay, can you narrow that down for us just a little bit? What would the right number be?
Well, Smetters says, actually, ideally, the savings rate will naturally adjust to the right level. This is just one of those beautiful ideas in the free market.
Fortunately, what you and I do, what's individually in terms of what's best for us, is usually what's best also for the general economy. And the reason why is because of prices. Prices will adjust to make it work right. So, for example, if everybody were saving so much, that it seemed like it was too high. Well, you know, prices of a lot of goods and services are going to potentially go way down. And at some point, you and I are going to flip and say, hey, you know, I can buy this cheap. I'm going to start consuming a little bit more. And prices will get us to do the right thing in terms of what's best for maximizing our welfare over our lifetime, as well as in terms of what's best for society.
So what you just told me there, though, is that basically whatever savings rate people are saving is right and appropriate. They're just responding to properly to, you know, the market and the situation out there. But you also told me at the beginning that you think we're not saving enough, right?
Exactly. So if there's any paradox, that's the issue. I believe that the reason why we're not saving enough is because we're simply discouraged in our society from saving a lot. And one way we're discouraged from doing that is that we have programs like Social Security and Medicare, which makes sense. They provide for us an older age. The problem, though, is that government is not actually funding those programs. They finance those programs on a pay-as-you-go basis. That is on a deficit basis. And so you and I rationally save less because we are covered under those programs, under the safety net, and that's what's best for us. And if the government were in fact saving the contributions that we're making to those programs and so forth, and that would be a problem, because instead of us doing the saving, the government's doing the saving for us. The problem is the government's not actually saving that money. And that's why we can have people now doing what's best for themselves, but what's not best for society.
I see. So you'd say the market is not working here, right? I mean, we're not saving because we say it's okay, the government's saving up for us, which would be fine, but you say the government is not actually saving for us.
Right. If we didn't have the government, I think the market, households would be saving a lot more. We have evidence from other countries showing that. When they have smaller Social Security welfare programs and so forth, households respond. They save more. The problem is that our government is the one who's dropping the ball. They're not saving. But it still looks like it's saving from our individual perspective.
I have this sense, and I know people have been pointing out problems with Social Security for ages, but right. I have this sense we may, you know, maybe this is the next coming storm, and we will look back on this conversation and say, yep.
Yeah, in fact, unfortunately, the storm in Social Security and Medicare is actually a lot bigger than the subprime mess. Right now, Social Security and Medicare face present value shortfalls of about $70 to $80 trillion, again, depending whose numbers that you believe. And these are very significant shortfalls. And so I believe the current subprime-driven type mess that we're in, it's basically just the appetizer for what's coming down the road. And it's in another decade or so, we're going to feel tremendous pressure from both Social Security and Medicare.
Isn't it true, though, that you could fix it just by saying, sorry, we're not going to pay you as much in Social Security as we told you we were? And then,
oh, sure.
Then it's not an X-trillion-dollar problem. Then it's just done. I mean, that's very painful, but you could just do that.
Yeah, well, that was a little aside. It's very painful. But are you going to be the one who proposes that? I mean, if you propose that, whatever office that you're holding, you can almost rest assured you're not holding that office for very long. Basically, right now, if we cut Social Security and Medicare in half immediately, and did that permanently, we would basically be able to balance out those systems. So I'm talking about your 70, 80-year-old grandmother. We literally told her today, we're going to cut your benefit in half immediately. And your Medicare benefit, by the way, we're not going to pay for that open heart surgery anymore, or we'll pay for half of it and you have to pay for the other half. And we did that permanently going forward. Then we could basically barely balance out those two systems.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who really depend on that money. And it's like, you know, people get upset when you raise taxes a few percent. We're talking about seriously cutting money people were promised.
Right. And so the way to do it rationally is to phase it in over time. You basically say, you know, if you're above age 55 or whatever you think is a reasonable cutoff age, you're not going to be touched by any of these actions. But, you know, below that age, you know, we're going to have to start scaling back.
David, do you ever get the feeling that we were just born at the wrong time in American history?
I'm definitely going to start saving a little more if I can.
Yeah, and you've already explained to us about the paradox of thrift and why that's so bad for the economy. That was Kent Smetters. He's a professor at the Wharton Business School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you, David.
Next time on Planet Money, we get the blow-by-blow account of the takeover of a bank by the FDIC, all the secret BlackBerry messages, the aliases at the hotel check-in, the late-night sandwiches, and we talk to the chief operating officer of the FDIC, and we press him about the FDIC's own finances.
Until then, we're on the blog at npr.org/money. I'm Laura Conaway.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Thank you very much for listening.